Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Datasets, particularly from the ESMO meeting, and the Management of Gynecologic Cancers. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Richard Penson from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Hi. Krishna Tiwari from the University of California, Irvine in Irvine, California. As with all our webinars, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all our webinars, we have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey in the chat room for you to take. You'll get a lot more out of this if you take that, and we'll learn a little bit about you. This is the first of three sort of post-ESMO, post-summer reviews of new data sets we're doing. On Thursday, we'll talk about breast cancer presentations, particularly from ESMO, a lot of really great, maybe even practice-changing. And then next week, we'll dive into lung cancer, both non-small cell and small cell. We're actually going to spend an hour and a half next week on that because so many things happened in lung. Then on Thursday, November 16th, we'll finish out our upper GI gastroesophageal Meet the Professor series with Dr. Klempner, Dr. Penson's colleague at MGH. Then on the 29th, we'll be working with Dr. Goyal and Javi, talking about all the new changes, including targeted therapy for biliary tract cancers. And then, as we always do in December, the first week, we'll head out to San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposia. We'll do three CME programs there, and then we'll fire over there to San Diego, where we'll do four CME programs at the ASH meeting. Should be an interesting week. All those programs will be broadcast live and online. Then next March, we're reawakening our weekend-long CME platform with the Florida Cancer Specialist here at our hometown in Miami. We'll talk more about that as we get closer, but that should be a great weekend. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Backus, our reviewing papers from the ASCO meeting. But here we're here to talk about mainly about what happened at ESMO, some few things also from the ASCO meeting, and also just the general update of what's going on. As always, we probably will get into a number of unapproved indications in our discussion of the risk-benefit profiles of these therapies. We asked both of the faculty to put together a presentation, but we're kind of going to weave that into this hour-long webinar. Here are some of the papers we asked the faculty to cover, particularly, again, from the ESMO meeting, but you'll also see a few others sprinkled in there from others, but particularly the ESMO meeting had a lot of great gynecologic oncology papers. Dr. Penson reviewed the ovarian papers, and Dr. Huari, the cervical and endometrial cancer. And this, of course, follows up the big SGO meeting earlier this year where we saw two phase three endometrial papers presented, and we're going to talk about that. They were followed up at ASCO at the ESMO meeting. Here's where we're heading. We're going to talk about endometrial cancers. Then we'll talk about cervical cancer, mainly what's new. And then a little bit of an update on ovarian cancer and also what was new, particularly from ESMO. But I want to just start out with something we're hearing more and more about, which is the idea of pan-tumor indications for therapy. And one that has gotten a lot of attention, and we're covering it in our lung programs, in our upper GI programs, our colorectal programs, our biliary tract programs, HER2-positive disease, HER2-positive solid tumors. And Krishna, we saw some data at the ESMO meeting and actually a simultaneous presentation looking at T-DXd in non-breast cancer tumors, a bunch of cancers I think people may be surprised to see there, and a lot of interesting activity. So can you talk a little bit about this paper, what they saw, and then we'll see what Richard thinks about it.
Yeah, this was a very exciting paper because I've highlighted or I've circled the cervical cancer cohort, the endometrial cancer cohort, but it also includes ovary, and you can see that just below that. And so this column here are the all comers for PFS and the IHC 3+, and then all comers again for OS and IHC 3+. And you can see in the cervical cancer cohort, here's your objective response rate. 50% of ORR in all comers, 75%
moved it forward to the design.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So that's perfect. And so you can see there's substantial activity in endometrial cancer, in cervical cancer, and ovarian cancer. Certainly, it's highest amongst the patients that have that are IHC 3 plus for HER2. But even in all comers, you can see really good objective responses, median PFS, median OS. And what's most important is this would be a agnostic indication, an agnostic tumor indication, a tumor agnostic indication, if you will, for this medicine for all these other cancers. And it's very, very exciting. Great study.
So, Richard, I'm curious about your take on it. And also, of course, this is the big issue in breast cancer, is whether or not it also provides benefit in so-called HER2 low. So IHC 1 plus, 2 plus, still not FISH positive, now routinely being used in metastatic HER2 low breast cancer, but I think now just beginning to be looked at in other cancers. Any comments on what we're seeing here, Richard? Of course, right now there isn't not a pan-tumor indication. You know, each one has to get their own indication. But any comments about where you see this agent heading in gynecologic cancers?
No, I think it's coming because we have arrived at an era where every tumor is a rare tumor. There's so many subsets and now really eloquent companion diagnostics to pick out the patients who are going to get the maximum benefit. There's a few issues. So we've come to this through high-grade serous tumors in the endometrial cancer group and carcinosarcomas. But now we have the marker alone driving it. That's really helpful. The interesting thing about these bars is how much the HER3 expression contributes to the benefit from the whole group. So the HER2, you got a substantially lesser, in some places nearly half the chance. Look at the BTC, for example. There are some tumors where you really need high expression, but overall it's really exciting and it feels like this is the way forward.
Of course, on the other hand, there also the issue of toxicity. And while antibody drug conjugates, which is what TDXD is to HER2 in general, seem to be better tolerated than chemotherapy, although they do seem to have chemotherapy-like acute side effects. Krishna, this is some of the data from the same paper looking at toxicity. And of course, the big concern with TDXD is interstitial lung disease. This was, of course, first picked up in breast cancer. There were actually deaths. And I think there have been deaths observed in all the other cancers where TDXD is looked at. Any comments about how this is going to be new for the gynecologic oncologists? The medical oncologists use TDXD like it's water, but it's going to be a new experience for the gynecologic oncologists, particularly this issue of ILD, Krishna. Any comments on that? I guess they did see a couple or three grade 5 events here.
That's right. So I think there's definitely going to be a learning curve amongst GYN oncologists if we do get a tissue agnostic indication for this medication. And I hope we do. And we're going to have to be very cautious. We're going to have to learn from our medical oncology colleagues that have used this for several years now in breast cancer. But that is an issue, and it's going to be going to require very careful patient counseling because, you know, grade 5 events are nothing to overlook.
So, yeah, I'm curious, Richard, what your thoughts are about this. You know, the way it's been approached in breast cancer, they're pretty aggressive about screening for ILD. They'll do preemptive CAT scans, looking for radiologic findings, even if the patient is asymptomatic. And the reason is because, at least in breast cancer, they have this algorithm that if you develop symptomatic ILD, that's it. You're not getting any more TDXD. So people are trying to pick it up when it's asymptomatic. I don't know that all the disciplines have exactly picked up the same algorithm. But any thoughts, Richard? I don't know about particularly this issue of toxicity.
Yeah, I think a few. So this is back to bleomycin. You know, 1% of bleomycin patients die from toxicity. And in that, we now know, you know, renal dysfunction, high peak doses. We think this is the sort of shedding of the payload in the lung. And the sort of concern about fatal toxicity is real. Any symptoms and getting a CAT scan and discontinuing treatment, steroids help. This is very different from mirvetuximab. So in GYN, in ovarian cancer, there's quite a bit of pneumonitis, but it's sort of florid on CAT scan, minimally symptomatic, never fatal. This is very different. And so I think, you know, scheduled CAT scans and CAT scan as soon as people develop desaturation symptoms, and you have to be vigilant.
It's interesting, Krishna. I did an interview this afternoon with Dr. Brovsky from the University of Pittsburgh. He's a breast cancer specialist, and we were talking about TDXD, and he was saying he's had the experience many times of, first of all, it works in breast cancer, you know, like it's working here. Patients do really well, but he has had a lot of patients who have great responses, and then they get this sort of nondescript thing on their CAT scan, and you know, they don't know what it is. It could be pneumonitis. Like you say, a lot of other things can cause pneumonitis. But, you know, they hate to stop the therapy because the patient's doing so well. Right. So I guess this is going to be, like I said, you know, a whole new world for gynecologic oncology, I think, Krishna.
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing that we've learned is, you know, we used to be pretty concerned about, you know, starting steroids too early. But now I think we're much more comfortable, you know, jumping on board with steroids.
And the therapeutic window is incredibly narrow. So with mirvetuximab, we went from 6 to 7 milligrams per kilogram. We see much more pneumonitis. And that's the issue with the ADCs. They're fabulous because they're targeted, silver bullet in action. But when you're just out of that therapeutic window, there can be a lot of toxicity.
Yeah, and there was a paper in Lung where they looked at a lower dose of TDXD. It looked like it worked just as well. Here's the paper. The simultaneous presentation, you want to read more about this really important data set. I also want to ask you, anytime something has the last name of DXD, it gets my attention. And there's more and more. There's a bunch of, you know, Dato DXD just had two big presidential ESMO, one in breast and the other in lung. So this is a very interesting payload here. And this is one I never heard of before. I think it's targeting something different. Richard, you put together a few slides on RDXD, and I guess this is targeting, what's the thing called?
So it's
anti-CDH6, cadherin.
Yeah, so like it's helpful if I make the full confession. So I hadn't heard of this either. There are lots of ADCs in development, and Radalotatug, it's just impossible to say RDXD. So it targets cadherin 6, which is like an integrin. It's a surface molecule that is an adhesion molecule, not so much signaling as there. And so they looked at these doses. You can see the really narrow therapeutic window. And then they actually went back and they're re-examining the 5.6. A response rate of 46%, and this duration of response, 11 months, really exciting, quite potent, very similar to when we were first looking at mirvetuximab. And then you see on the left, treatment-related deaths, 2 out of 60 participants, same concerns as TDXD. But on the right, no eye toxicity, less liver heme toxicity. This is recrafting chemotherapy for efficacy, and a 46% response rate with an 11-month duration response, really exciting.
Yeah, that sounds really exciting. As you say, we already have one ADC, mirvetuximab. It'll be exciting to see whether we can get this one. Let's dive into some of the papers specifically, first of all, related to endometrial cancer. So as I mentioned, you know, the big issue that I'm seeing really popped up this year in a very strong way, which is the issue of immunotherapy. And just to kind of sum, before we get into kind of what the papers that were presented, particularly at ESMO, just to sort of say kind of where we were before ESMO or where we are right now, Krishna, obviously we had the two big phase 3 studies. Previously, Immunotherapy in endometrial cancer is often given second line in the MS-stable patients. Lenvatinib and pembrolizumab has been a typical second line therapy. And of course, the obvious question is, what about bringing it in first line like it is in many of the other solid tumors? So you had two big studies, and those studies were followed up at ESMO. You're going to go through what the design was and the follow-ups, so we saw more data. But now we saw a third phase three trial, now looking at atezo. Not very surprising. Seems like it happens in all the major tumors. But kind of interesting in terms of what was seen with this third new study. And then there were several other endometrial papers presented. But I think the main thing we're going to focus on is the issue of first-line therapy of metastatic disease. So I think we spent almost all our time, our rehearsal time, talking about this issue because it's just so complicated. But why don't we just start out and let you, first of all, talk about what we saw at ESMO, and then I'm going to try to get the two of you to tell us what this all means in terms of taking care of patients tomorrow morning in clinic. So
all
go
right,
ahead,
Chris. Great.
So this is the RUBY study.
Yeah, so the RUBY study was chemotherapy with or without dostarlimab, which is an anti-PD-1. We heard about it at the SGO meeting in March. It met its primary endpoint for PFS. It led to a label for the mismatch repair deficient patients in July of this year for advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer, MMR deficient. And now in this follow-up study, Dr. Mirza, who presented the primary endpoint in March, presented at ESMO 2 weeks ago, this data looking at the subgroups according to molecular classification using the classification scheme that we learned or we've taken from the Cancer Genome Atlas for endometrial cancer. And let's go ahead and advance this. We'll just take a look here. Here's the PFS according to the molecular subgroup. You can see the POLE mutants. There's not very many of them in this study, but they do very well, and that's as expected according to the Cancer Genome Atlas. POLE mutants do not fare so poorly. But if you can see here, patients who got dostarlimab that were mismatch repair deficient, a reduction in the hazard of progression of death or death of 69%. Patients that were P53 mutants, 45% reduction in the hazard of progression or death. And then, of course, there seems to be benefit also in the mismatch repair proficient patients with a 33% reduction in the hazard of progression or death. If we look over here at the numbers of patients in this study, and you can see the four different molecular classification schemes that we got from the TCGA for endometrial cancer, the POLE mutants, the mismatch repair deficient, which is about 22-23% of the study population, aberrant P53 expression, 22% as well. And you can see this RUBY molecular classification algorithm kind of mirrors what we see in the real world when we're taking care of endometrial patients and we're sequencing them. And so this was a copy of the press release that was released a week ago. So the study that Mirza presented at ESMO 2 weeks ago was followed up a week later. GSK issued this press release that RUBY met its second primary endpoint. So they had dual primary endpoints, PFS and OS. And we had the PFS results back in March. And now we have a statistically significant improvement in overall survival in all comers, mismatch repair deficient, as well as the mismatch repair proficient patient subgroups. So this is very exciting. I think, Neil, this will certainly convert the accelerated approval that occurred in July for the mismatch repair deficient patients to full approval. As to what it will do for the mismatch repair proficient patients, I don't know how the FDA is going to go with that, but this is very exciting news. All right. Dr. Eskander presented NRG GY018 at the SGO in March, and that's the doppelganger study, or the it's its own study, similar to RUBY. It's chemotherapy plus IO upfront with patients with advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. They all had to have measurable disease, and the difference between this study and the RUBY study, whereas the RUBY study had dual primary endpoints, PFS and OS. GY018, the NRG study, its sole primary endpoint was PFS, but the way the study was designed, there were two cohorts that were the study was powered for, the mismatch repair proficient and the mismatch repair deficient. And Dr. Eskander provided an updated objective response rates in both of these populations. And you can see here in red, the patients who got pembrolizumab that were mismatch repair deficient, 82% objective response. And even in the mismatch repair proficient patients, again, this is a separate cohort, two studies embedded within the same trial, adequately powered in both, 71% objective response in the mismatch repair proficient. Now, GY018, this NRG trial, the FDA has not yet made a decision either way with the mismatch repair deficient or all comers, but we are anticipating learning what their decision is hopefully sometime soon, because we really do want to get this IO into the front line for our patients with advanced recurrent endometrial cancer. Now, at end is the is another study. This is the first time we're hearing about it at ESMO, whereas the NRG study with Pembro, we heard about at SGO, as well as the RUBY study with dostarlimab. At end is a little bit different. It's chemo plus IO, but this time the IO target is PD-L1, not PD-1. So this is looking at atezolizumab, randomized study, chemotherapy with or without atezolizumab, placebo-controlled. And you can see here with the results, the primary endpoint was significantly improved progression-free survival amongst patients that were mismatch repair deficient. In the all comers, there is some separation of the curves, not as great. And let's see, do we have, and this is the OS, the PFS and OS in the mismatch repair proficient patients. And you can see that they did not fare so well, especially in terms of OS, where the hazard ratio is 1.00. So atezolizumab certainly active in the mismatch repair deficient patients population. It's, I would say this is a confirmatory study of the activity of checkpoint plus chemotherapy in the frontline. It confirms what we saw and learned in RUBY and NRG-018. And it's a slightly different molecule, anti-PD-L1. Had a couple other studies. Here we can see this is the forest plot. And if you see what we boxed here, you can see that atezolizumab certainly has activity when it comes to the primary endpoint amongst the mismatch repair deficient patients. Now, DUO-E, this is also an exciting study that was presented at ESMO 2 weeks ago. And this is targeting, looking at chemotherapy plus durvalumab and also adding a PARP inhibitor. The idea being that these patients that have mismatch repair deficiency or even other mutations, for example, P53 mutations, they may be, their tumor substrates may be ripe for harnessing the activity of PARP inhibitors. So in this study, our control arm was chemotherapy alone, but we also had two other investigational arms, chemotherapy plus durvalumab, followed by durvalumab maintenance, and then chemotherapy plus durvalumab followed by durvalumab maintenance along with olaparib maintenance. So a little bit of a complicated study design, but the basic way to think about this trial is there's a chemotherapy alone control, and then there's two other arms, either studying chemotherapy plus durvalumab with maintenance durvalumab or chemotherapy plus durvalumab followed by maintenance durvalumab plus olaparib. And you can see here that the two investigational arms did report out a significant improvement in PFS in the intention to treat population. Neil, go. You have a question.
Yeah, I think let's just take a breath here and kind of pull this together and kind of get into what it actually means. So I want to ask Richard, let's start out with metastatic MSI-high disease, where clearly you see a great benefit in all these studies by the introduction of an IO. But the question I have for you, Richard, is, you know, in colorectal cancer, MSI high, they just get the IO. They don't get chemotherapy. And I want to know how you feel about giving chemotherapy plus an IO to MSI high. Suppose the patient's older, you know, that doesn't want chemo. Are you okay using IO alone?
So that you made that confession that this is complicated. And the reason is because the subsets. So what you just said, those 18 patients from ASCO, they're spared chemo radiation therapy with rectal cancer. That's just like amazing. 100% response rate. Can't ignore that. That is about 30%, a third of endometrial cancer. In the POLE patients, probably is close to 100%. Single agent pembrolizumab is probably all you need. And then, you know, you saw a PFS advantage of 50% in the hormonally sensitive, that bottom right group. So like hormone plus pembro improves PFS by 50%. If we do the right study, we'll probably get that answer. You know, frontline pembrolizumab, frontline checkpoint inhibitor should be given. So POLE just needs pembro, checkpoint inhibitor. Then you add checkpoint inhibitor to P53 mutant or microsatellite unstable high. It looks like a winner, but we've got to wait for overall survival. And then we've just got to get the right therapy for that fourth group.
So and that fourth group, the MS stable, which is in the past, or, you know, recent, up until recently, Krish, MS stable would get chemo first line and lenvatinib pembro second line. And so you have to kind of weigh the question of, do you want to give the IO first line with the chemo or second line with lenvatinib? Any thoughts about how you would like, you know, putting aside FDA indications, Krish, how would you like to treat first line therapy MS stable disease?
I really hope that we could, we'll get, well, whether there's a label or not, I really hope we can bring IO plus chemotherapy to those patients. And this study, what this study makes me think about is, for those mismatch repair proficient patients, maybe the addition of olaparib, a PARP inhibitor, it doesn't have to be olaparib, but whatever's been studied may help those patients. Because in this study, in the mismatch repair proficient patients, there appeared to be some improvement in PFS when olaparib was included in the treatment or in the maintenance regimen.
Could we just stay on the slide a second? Krish, what did you think about the PD-L1? Because we really think that's not a marker in endometrial cancer. And yet in this group, it was. And so defining a heated up immune microenvironment has been really challenging. And so I think PD-L1 may be one of the interesting hypotheses that comes out of this study.
No question. And, you know, it's interesting because the PD-L1 expression in endometrial cancer, for example, is not as high as it is in cervix cancer, where it's very difficult to tease out, who doesn't need checkpoint in cervix, because PD-L1 expression can be as high as 80 to 90% in cervix, but in here it's different. So I think it's a very important hypothesis. I totally agree.
So I want to get to cervical cancer, because again, we can spend all day long talking about endometrial cancer, but I want to try to get into some of these other papers as well and other questions that come up. This was a paper looking at that was presented at ESMO, looking at patients who did get the current second-line therapy for MS stable pembro lenvatinib, particularly the patients who were able to complete the pembro and stay in lenvatinib maintenance. And still a lot of people are getting this combination. And of course, Richard, just I always like to touch base with where people are in terms of dosing. It's been so controversial over the last few years of lenvatinib. They're the people who like to start out full dose, others start lower. As others like 18 milligrams because you have different size pills. What's your current approach to dosing in second line lenvatinib pembro, Richard?
So I'm a wuss. I give 110 and 14 milligrams. And then if patients just are golden, and you know 3 days into treatment if it's going to be a breeze, it's very rarely a breeze. You can double up on the 4 milligrams, go to 18. We rarely ever give 20 milligrams. I know a lot of surgical colleagues who start at 20 and believe that that first few weeks of saving people from the slippery slope is essential. What this study taught me is that we desperately want like a randomized discontinuation study. Mark Retain was one of the kings of that sort of thing. It would be so nice to do, say, a year, one of the things we haven't talked about is you can tell at 1 year the tumors that are really going to respond, endometrial tumors, the microsatellite stable high, it really looks like you, like Dave O'Malley's single agent data, looks like 1 year is all you need when you're really going to get benefit. So for the tougher to treat patients, I would love to see discontinuing lenvatinib and trying bevacizumab instead at that time point. But I don't think there's any, that's no plans to test that sort of thing. But we need to work out what is a quality-friendly, optimal strategy, because this is a tough regimen.
So I want to kind of get through these so we can get to cervical cancers. I'm just going to ask you a couple questions about some of these other papers, and then we're going to move on. So, Chris, we're hearing more and more about neoadjuvant IOs for MSI-high disease in general. There's a big memorial paper that made the New York Times looking at rectal cancer. I'm hearing more and more about it. Clearly, patients respond. Here's some data from ESMO, a waterfall plot, just a small number of patients, but I guess is maybe not quite ready for exactly prime time yet, but something that looks pretty exciting for the future. Chris, do you ever do this outside of trial setting?
No, I haven't, but I'm sure thinking about it after seeing this. I mean, at least half of the patients had a pathologic CR, where there was just like less than 10% viable tumor once they had surgery. And this is just after two cycles of preoperative IO. So it's hypothesis generating, it's interesting, it's exciting. And sometimes, you know, that's what we need to do. We don't have any trials of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, no good ones in endometrial cancer, but we do it all the time. But maybe we should be checking MSI status and talking to patients about neoadjuvant checkpoint prior to surgery in patients with very extensive disease. So this paper got me thinking. It's pretty exciting. It's small numbers, but the pathologic responses were remarkable.
Yeah. There's an interesting anecdote, Neil. So the reason we give six cycles is George Canellos has a beautiful mind. So two cycles mostly works in lymphoma, two more, everybody's in remission, and two more for good effect. That's where six comes from. And so two cycles,
cool.
6 weeks of treatment. Yeah, that is true. 6 weeks of treatment for when a treatment is really effective, it really makes a difference. Chris is going to tell you about that in cervix cancer. And this is that sort of thing.
So, yeah, I want to get to cervical cancer because there are a couple of really important papers here. You can check out some of these other papers that Chris pulled. This one we were talking about, PARP inhibitors and endometrial cancer. Is that ever going to become a reality? We already talked a little bit about data. I think we'll just go ahead and skip through your case here, Chris, because I want to get to your cervical case. So let's talk about cervical cancer. And we saw several papers in earlier stage disease, Chris. Of course, we already have IOs as an important part of therapy in metastatic disease. I think we saw some follow-up from the main study there. But here we saw a bunch of other studies, including this one, which is not an IO. It's just chemotherapy, but it was a positive study. So, Chris, what did we learn about cervical cancer and IOs and cervical cancer and induction chemo?
Yeah, we had two great papers. This paper, Interlace, was actually in the presidential symposium for ESMO, the second presidential symposium. And this was looking at patients with locally advanced disease that is too advanced to cut out. So you can't do a hysterectomy on these patients, but it hasn't metastasized. And the idea here was to give induction chemotherapy, two cycles of carboplatin plus paclitaxel before proceeding with definitive chemoradiation. And this was the first study in over two decades in this disease space that showed an overall survival benefit. We've had about nine other studies in locally advanced disease since the 1999 papers in the New England Journal of Medicine, which showed a survival benefit with adding cisplatin to radiation. But this is the first study to show a survival benefit in locally advanced disease. You can see the PFS and the OS curves here. And like I've said before, what's nice about this study is we don't have to wait for FDA approval to talk to patients about this tomorrow morning. This is chemotherapy, as you said. It's not a novel agent, but two cycles of induction chemo prior to definitive chemo radiation, and we have a survival benefit. Really exciting stuff. And then A18, the KEYNOTE-A18 study, is again looking at the same group of patients, locally advanced disease. These are high-risk patients. So these are patients who have two or more nodes on imaging that is 1.5 centimeters in short axis. So these are a high-risk group of women with locally advanced disease, chemo radiation with or without pembrolizumab. And this study met its primary endpoint, progression-free survival. You can see it on the left. Overall survival's not mature yet, but you can see the curves are beginning to separate. And so the trend looks like it's going to favor overall survival. And so this is going to, if this study does show an overall survival benefit and the FDA approves this, it's going to completely change our landscape for managing cervical cancer, because right now, chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab with or without bevacizumab is approved for recurrent and newly diagnosed metastatic cervix cancer. But if we're going to move checkpoint into the front line with definitive chemo radiation, we're going to have to rethink what we do when patients relapse. So very exciting study, very important, both of these studies, Interlace and KEYNOTE-A18. And then, of course, the question becomes, well, if we do get a approval for the KEYNOTE-A18 regimen, and it's an all-comers approval, because in KEYNOTE-A18, these patients were not enriched for any biomarker like PD-L1 status. But the question is, are people going to consider doing Interlace induction chemotherapy before definitive chemo radiation plus checkpoint with pembrolizumab? So there is the possibility of combining Interlace with KEYNOTE-A18, although there is no study that's done that yet at this point, but it wouldn't be difficult for people to do if they considered the patients high risk enough, especially because tolerant toxicology with induction chemotherapy, there was some more myelosuppression as expected, but overall it was pretty well tolerated and patients were able to get to their chemo radiation and complete it. And then we know with A18 that pembrolizumab added to chemo radiation and then continued as a maintenance is also tolerable.
So I want to get Richard's take on this. Also, pun proppy in the chat room, Richard wants to know what kind of test you have to order in order to get a POLE-E. So first of all, let me let you answer that question.
So typical genotyping, many have in-house foundation will be able to do that sort of thing. Caris, there are so many now. So whatever your preferred genotyping of tumors is should be able to have POLE-E now.
So in terms of this really interesting and important paper that Chris just talked about, so I'm curious, I think we have a case here. Let me see if I've got, yeah, here we go. I think this case actually really is the question. And I guess what I want to ask, Chris, maybe you can briefly, Chris, explain the situation with this 56-year-old woman and sort of putting aside reimbursement based on what you saw at ESMO. I'll be curious to know what you two think the optimal therapy for this woman would be in this situation. What happened with her? She had a fungating 5-centimeter mass.
Yep. So this is a 56-year-old real patient presented with left flank pain and vaginal discharge. As you said, she had a fungating 5-centimeter mass. Biopsy confirmed a grade 3 squamous cancer. She was evaluated. Imaging showed left hydronephrosis, some adenopathy, but no metastatic disease. She was staged according to the FIGO 2018 classification system as a stage 3C. R, the R meaning she's a 3C based on radiographic findings. So these are the treatment options. Standard therapy would be platinum-based chemoradiation followed by high-dose rate intracavitary brachytherapy. That's standard of care. But she's a pretty sick patient. You know, she's got extensive adenopathy of blocked kidney. So one thing we could consider is induction chemotherapy, the Interlace study followed by definitive chemoradiation. Or, you know, if we can just imagine a world where KEYNOTE-A18 has been approved, an option would be chemo radiation plus pembrolizumab. Or should we combine Interlace and KEYNOTE-A18? So what would you do, Richard?
So my bias, so I'm like a real doctor. So like I sit in front of a patient and I have real existential angst about these things. So I think at one extreme, we have to practice evidence-based medicine. So with endometrial cancer patients, I have an honest conversation about we're waiting for some subset overall survival data before we really know. So, but to quote Mary McCormack, this is ready for, or Interlace is ready for adoption. So I'd have no problem with doing this. Philosophically, at the other end of the spectrum, I also would have no problem. I would say to a patient, you know, how do you feel about off-label therapy? I have a committee to go through. We have to get financial approval for free drug. It's a lot of work, but why not try it? Would you be up for immunotherapy? It's not the standard of care. That group, half the endometrial cancer patients with the low copy number, the hormonally driven tumors, 2 years of hormonal therapy is going to be tested in the Rainbow trial. Adding an aromatase inhibitor to oophorectomy as your hormonal intervention in a high-risk patient, I have no problem with that. But patients need to know when we're practicing off-label medicine. And so you have to have a very honest discussion about the uncertainties, the extra risks when you leave the safety of really sound evidence base. But I liked her language, ready for adoption. I think Interlace is really cool. There was a great study, ICON 8B, weekly Taxol, actually has an overall survival in Europe, which is just amazing. So getting your frontline therapy, that for ovarian cancer, right, optimal therapy really makes a difference. And then, you know, IP therapy, it drops off the map because it's horribly toxic. But some of these cocktails of things where different trials inform great choices, it's an exciting time where we have much better informed care.
Well, also, I'm sitting back here knowing that for the last 5 years, one of the most successful uses of IOs that I've observed, just sort of seeing what's going on, is with chemo radiation and lung cancer. The Pacific trial, really a landmark study where they added in durvalumab after chemo radiation, big effect, curves never came together. It really gave a lot of hope to the pulmonary docs like 3, 4, 5 years ago. And I wonder if what's going to, you know, that's kind of, you guys are sort of following in the same area. And speaking of antibody drug conjugates, here's another one. Just a quick update. We saw, I guess, a definitive a presentation of this, although it's already been approved and being utilized. Can you just sort of summarize, Krish, what Dr. Vergote presented on tisotumab? And I'm curious from both of you what your experiences have been with this agent, particularly in terms of tolerability.
Yeah. So this is the registration trial, the TV204 study, phase two study, objective response, about 24% got an accelerated approval for this medicine for second line and beyond cervix cancer, not biomarker specific. And this was the registration study and randomized phase three trial, and it showed or demonstrated a significant improvement in overall survival. Let's take a look at the curves here. There you can see that was the primary endpoint. And so this will most likely convert the accelerated approval of tisotumab vedotin to full approval in the United States and also introduce a new medicine for cervical cancer to Europe because, you know, this is the first time the Europeans are seeing it. For me, you know, we have the FDA in the United States has a very clear ocular mitigation program. Patients need to be seen by an ophthalmologist before every treatment, or not an ophthalmologist, an eye care specialist. They need a visual acuity exam and a slit lamp examination. And then they take three different types of eye drops throughout the 3 weeks that they're getting while they're on therapy. So during therapy, they take vasoconstricting eye drops and steroid eye drops. And then for 2 days after therapy, they continue with the steroid eye drops. And then for the rest of the month until the next dose comes up, they take just lubricating eye drops. And then they have cooling packs for the eye pads. They're not supposed to wear contact lenses. And I've not really had any. I've had dry eyes in a couple patients, but I haven't had any corneal ulcerations. There was one case of a grade 3 corneal ulceration in the phase 2, the TV204 study. But I have I've got several patients on this medication. It's been very tolerable.
So yeah, that's my way of doing patient reported outcomes, is to say, Dr. Penson, I'm just kind of curious, can you just kind of give me a broad view of what you generally see when you put patients on tisotumab? Do they usually respond? What's their quality of life? Like, globally, how does this drug fit in your practice?
Yeah, so the mirvetuximab is half as often they have to actually see the eye specialist. And so the inconvenience of that is not inconsiderable. I've only treated two people off protocol, and they both did great. One has already had progression of disease, so she blew out a fistula just recently. And so it's a bit sobering how awful cervical cancer is. So part of my message would be, this is a great drug. Let's work to move it up front, and let's work to get immunotherapy to get fewer people with recurrent disease in the future.
Let's work to get fewer people with the disease and prevent it to start all with. That's together. The first thing I thought of. If you have 5 centimeter fulgating mass, a horrible thing. For yes. Preventable disease. All right, let's finish out about ovarian cancer. Usually we spend like an hour, who knows, on ovarian cancer. You can talk forever on that. We did see some update on mirvetuximab. But what I want to do first, and this is a couple slides you put together, Richard, kind of looking back, is just take a deep breath and do what I've been doing, I feel like, a lot the last 5 years, which is just asking you all, like, what are you doing about upfront maintenance? And I kind of see over time, you start to see people kind of glide around in different spaces. So I'm kind of curious where you two are. First of all, before I kind of get more specific about my questions, anything you want to say, Richard, sort of reflecting back on this whole saga over the last decade with PARP inhibitors, any global comments?
Yeah, so I think the reason I put this timeline together is these are the approvals, FDA on the upper, European approvals on the lower, and then those three letters, we're going to show you the detail in a second, voluntary withdrawal of indication for treatment in later lines. And then this year, in August, another letter from AstraZeneca saying second line therapy for only BRCA mutated disease. So the big splash is for the up to a quarter of patients with a BRCA mutation, 2/3 inherited, who are going to do amazingly with frontline PARP inhibitor, 44% better survival at 7 years, like just curing more people. And so the randomized trials have been the source, Ariel 4, Nova, Solo 3. So I led Solo 3. I've had the heartache of seeing trauma from this drug in patients. So now for second line for niraparib and rucaparib, a third line and a later lines of therapy, a very consistent hazard ratio, 30% worse in terms of overall survival for all three drugs. So we really can't use this drug. All of us, I don't know about all of us, but everybody that I've asked, we have patients who are late line and desperately dependent on their PARP inhibitor. I have patients at 8.5 years on a PARP inhibitor. That's got a 10% risk of leukemia, and we worry about those patients. So,
before we get to that, I just wanted to, sort of get your thoughts about where things are for practical purposes now. Because honestly, I try to read through all the things that have happened over the last couple of years, and it's a little bit confusing to me. So, I always kind of flip back to what do you do? I mean, we can talk all day long about everything that's happened, but really a lot of it relates to what do you do in your practice. So I tried to think about a couple, rather than go through the whole thing, which usually takes about an hour, I just picked out a couple of scenarios or situations just to kind of, as a reflection of where you both are in terms of these questions. So here are the two scenarios. I decided what I want to ask you about as a patient, let's just make it simple, BRCA germline. Or, I mean, we could say BRCA somatic, we could say PALB2. You know what I'm talking about, the highest, the patients who are going to benefit the most. So I just want to ask you about those patients right now. And of course, we could talk all day long about the BRCA wild type, the HRD proficient. So very controversial. But these are very important patients that have these alterations. So I've got a very straightforward question, which is how do you manage them in the upfront situation? And the real question I'm curious about is how do you manage them if they get into a recurrent situation and have not received a PARP inhibitor previously? So let's just talk about those two, not everything in the field. So first, let me start with you, Krish. In general, you got a patient, again, BRCA germline, BRCA1, whatever. You know the various scenarios that occur. Patients can present, need neoadjuvant therapy, others go to surgery. But in these patients, how do you think through maintenance? And of course, the issue is which PARP, for how long, and what about BEV?
Yeah, so germline BRCA mutation upfront approach is pretty straightforward. You know, going by the solo one, I would talk to them about, I give a lot of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, I take them to surgery, and then once they finish chemotherapy, I would talk to her about going taking the laparib and, you know, sharing with the patient the long-term follow-up results in solo one. For the patients who relapse, who've never had a PARP inhibitor, but they have a germline mutation, I'd be hard-pressed not to give them olaparib in that setting as well. And to be fair, niraparib's also indicated for that first patient, the upfront patient as well, because they have an all-comers indication. But my approach is to use olaparib. I think the solo one data is very strong for the upfront management approach. But a BRCA mutated patient in need of second line therapy who's never seen olaparib, I'd talk to them about that as well. Chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, if they're platinum sensitive, that's an option in the second line space also. And I do talk to patients about that.
So before I go to Richard, just to clarify, first of all, how long are you going to use it for? You say you prefer olaparib, although you mentioned niraparib. But niraparib was looked at for 3 years, olaparib for two. How, in this situation, how long are you going to give the olaparib?
I've been given in the upfront situation, I give it for 3 years. The FDA has said that, you know, if the doctor and the patient believe that there may be ongoing benefit, you can go beyond 2 years for olaparib.
So you give it for three?
Yep.
Okay. And then in what situations, if any, would you use PARP plus BEV in a BRCA patient?
Well, if they're HRD positive, BRCA wild type, I have an indication to use PARP plus bevacizumab, but I don't believe it's necessary if they've got a straight BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation in the tumor, germline, or somatic.
All right, so let me come back to you, Richard, because one of the things, you know, I'm just sitting here listening to you all, and I think that I'm starting to hear more of another answer, which is I'm starting to hear more BEV. But I'm just kind of curious where you fit in, Richard, because I've heard people, some of your colleagues, respond to the case I just presented and say, I'd use olaparib BEV. I'm like, well, why? And they would think, well, I think it's better. But again, upfront treatment, BRCA germline, Richard, what are you thinking?
Yeah, we do that. So half our patients get new adjuvant therapy. So it's chemo surgery, 2 years of olaparib or 3 years of niraparib. I typically try to persuade a patient to discontinue niraparib at 2 years. And I tell them if they don't have a BRCA mutation, which is normally the situation in that for that patient, maybe the risks are less high. But for the patient with a BRCA mutation, maybe a third of the risk is contributed by the platinum, two thirds by the PARP inhibitor. There's real risk. So I do not to treat for 3 years, 2 years on label for olaparib, or I would give 2 years of niraparib with that sort of discussion. The reason the PAOLA-1 data is so powerful is that very commonly for the sick patient with bad disease, we will start with the addition of bevacizumab. And so it's more, do we add the olaparib for the patients without the BRCA mutations? And yes, we do. They have HRD, there's an overall survival advantage. And there's a double overall survival advantage. King Krish Tiwari has demonstrated in the US patients that stage four disease, bevacizumab confers an overall survival advantage. So stage four HRD, they desperately need that cocktail. The PFS data is unequivocally the best for For the combination of bevacizumab and olaparib. So it is the best combination. But whether you need it, to use Krish's word, for the patient with a BRCA mutation, we don't know. Most people tend to just give their 2 years of olaparib for the BRCA mutant tumors.
So, Richard, this is kind of like tackling the Talmud here. I'd like to be honest about trials that I don't understand.
Yeah.
And the two duo ones are way up on my list. I'm always asking people to try to explain it to me better. So why don't you take a shot? We already talked about duo E. This is duo O.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So easier to say than some of the ADCs. And the preamble has to be that, you know, it has been an awful slog to try and get immunotherapy to work. And so we're really excited with this sort of data because it is the first study that's positive. So Philip Harter presented this at ASCO. And so three quite neat arms. Everybody gets bevacizumab. So chemotherapy, bevacizumab in arm one. And then you add the durvalumab in arm two, and the durvalumab and the maintenance olaparib in arm three. So quite a nicely constructed study. You might say, well, could we have had an arm without bevacizumab? But otherwise, it's a good design. So the study bottom line is this. So the PFS by HRD, so HRD positive, you'd sort of expect a little bit like the PAOLA-1 data, that purple line at the top, really pushing things out better. If you look at the PFS, 2 years goes out to sort of more than 3 years, which is just great. And then the HRD negative, a little bit like when we look at 218 and the ICON study, you see this bump in the PFS. So it works at the time you're most at risk. So remember, the reason we give 2 years of olaparib is to cover the most at risk for recurrence time. And then niraparib, I think, I do not know, this is gospel. I think they chose 3 years because they had more patients. The intention was intention to treat. And so they were covering a longer period of time with the drug, hoping for a better outcome or with a all-comer sort of intervention. But the HRD negative, a push in the middle, but not so clear a benefit. And then toxicities. One of the really reassuring things is there are a couple of studies which showed a very low rate of myelodysplastic syndrome leukemia. So you could absolutely say that this is early. We don't know yet. But that's what we're doing. We're getting better outcomes, less leukemia, because we're putting this up front rather than giving continuous treatment to patients who've had two lines of platinum before. And discontinuation is really very low, which is exciting. So a positive study, the first in ovarian cancer, and a hazard ratio that's really impressive, 0.49 for the HRD positive. And then not those HRD negative, but the all comers, 0.63, 37% better, which is really impressive. So I think this is a little bit like the PAOLA-1 study, that there may be the best outcomes when you add all three drugs together. Without overall survival advantage, that is not going to be popular. PAOLA-1, it's about $500,000 per quality adjusted progression-free survival year that you buy. That's $3 million for PAOLA-1. They're staggeringly cost ineffective drugs. And I don't think we've yet defined the group, say, with PD-L1, that we really can say when a patient needs a particular cocktail of treatment.
So maybe before we go into this, I just want to ask you about one other thing, because I think we're kind of running out of time, which is a couple of negative studies. And you know, as always, we know the audience will check out the full slide set, including the cases, to pick up some of the things that we didn't get into. But I just wanted to get both of your takes on, we've been talking about ADCs a lot today. I feel like we talk about ADCs every time we have a solid tumor CME program. Now, as we have more time to sort of process this, Krishna, can you comment a little bit about your experience with mirvetuximab, both in terms of response that you're seeing, but also tolerability? How much of an issue is the ophthalmic thing?
Yeah, with mirvetuximab, it's been interesting. You know, with the first ADC we got to use in gynecologic cancers was tisotumab in cervix. We talked about that earlier, but that's not biomarker restricted. This one is, and so I can't use it for all my platinum resistant patients like I'd like to. So I have to wait for the folate receptor testing. But the patients that I've been able to use this on, I've got about 5 or 6 patients since December when the drug was approved under the accelerated approval program. I've had zero eye toxicity. Zero eye toxicity, even though that is a concern with this medicine. And it's very well tolerated. The patients have responded. My first two patients have already come off therapy, but I have 3 patients that I probably started in March or April that are still on treatment with partial responses / stable disease. And they're tolerating it really well.
Any comments from you, Richard? You know, one of the things we hear, we were talking about TDXD earlier. There we hear about chemotherapy-like side effects, acute, you know, nausea and vomiting, preemptive medications used. What about mirvetuximab and tisotumab? Do you see chemotherapy-like effects also?
So this was the first drug for resistant disease, PFS, OS, and quality of life. Just fabulous data. My experience has been in late line therapy, you know, 9-10 prior lines, you do get like a few first days of jangling neurotoxicity, exhaustion, and some GI upset. So my experience has been, I didn't see that in the trials at all, because it was up to 3 prior lines. But when you give it late line, there's a little bit off label. Patients who've accrued a lot of cumulative treatment, it's a chemo drug.
Well, it also seems to cause responses, which is a good thing.
It's an effective chemo drug.
Chris and Richard, thank you so much for chatting with us today. We had a lot to try to get through. We had to skip a few things, but that's a good sign when there's so much to talk about, we can't even get through it. And that's going to happen on Thursday, same time, same place with Dr. Bardia and Tulaney. A lot of great presentations in breast cancer. We'll talk about Dato-DXD, another antibody-drug conjugate, updates on the adjuvant CDK inhibitors, and much, much more. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much,
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much,
Thank you
Richard.
So much.
Thank you.
Bye.